From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. For those of us who were totally swept up by her first novel, The Time Traveler's Wife, Audrey Niffenegger is back now with her second. It's called Her Fearful Symmetry, and it's a ghost story. Two young Americans, Julia and Valentina Poole, come to live in London. They're identical twins and unusually close. 21 years old, though, as Niffenegger writes, they were often mistaken for undernourished 12-year-olds. They've come to live in an apartment next to a cemetery. The flat was left to them by their aunt, Elspeth Noblin, who dies straight off in the first line of the book.
I have finally managed to achieve total efficiency in killing a character.
In the very first line of the book.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about the ghost story part of this and how that came to you.
Well, it would be somewhat unlikely and ridiculous for two 21-year-olds to be living by themselves in a stupendous flat in this particular part of London. It's a very expensive neighborhood. And so I was thinking, well, how can I get them there? And one of the things I'm doing in this book is taking all the old clichés and the workings of the 19th century English novel and trying to use them in a 21st century novel in a way that they make sense. And so reaching into the big bag of clichés, I decided that they had a rich relative who would die and leave them this flat. And the more I thought about their aunt, Elspeth, the more interested I got in her and the more I wanted to write about her, and I felt very, very sorry that I had killed her before she even got into the story. And so I started to move backward and finally arrived at the point where she dies, which is the thing that sets everything else in motion in this story, and decided that she would not go, she would become a ghost. And she's a very willful character, and it is her willfulness that stops her from simply dying and propels her into this limbo between life and death.
We should talk about, I think, what is fairly considered to be a real character in the book, and that is Highgate Cemetery in London, which is where Elspeth Noblin is buried. Tell us about Highgate.
Well, Highgate, of course, is a real place. It was started in 1839, and it's in an especially beautiful part of London. The Victorians decided that it would be okay to have these park-like cemeteries, and they're quite lovely. People came out and picnicked, and it was a beautiful place. Also, the city was very polluted, and Highgate's on a hill, so people would come out and get fresh air. And over the years, it filled up with all sorts of super amazing, interesting people, some of whom we've heard of, Karl Marx, Christina Rossetti, some of whom we haven't, but their life stories are fascinating. And I've been giving tours of the cemetery. In the process of researching my tour guide character, Robert, I had accumulated the knowledge set you need to actually give a tour. And so the people who run the cemetery noticed, and they said, well, make yourself useful.
There is so much death all through the novel, and to some extent also in The Time Traveler's Wife. Are you sort of playing with the aesthetics of death? I've been looking at a lot of your visual art online, too, and there are lots of drawings and prints of skeletons and sort of death iconography. What is that about?
I think I must have sprung from the womb looking at the other end of my life. I've always been interested in it. All the art that I was attracted to when I was young seemed to be, if not macabre, at least involving loss in some way.
Well, what do you think it is about death and dying and ghosts and cemeteries that has this appeal for you?
They're beautiful, which I know seems perverse since a lot of the time it's anything but. Violence does not especially attract me, nor do I try to aestheticize it. I take violence very seriously, and I'm not really too interested in making it into my art. Death, on the other hand, is something that will eventually happen to everybody, and it does seem important to think about it.
Did you ever find, when you were writing Her Fearful Symmetry, that you felt you had to pull back a bit, that maybe the death themes were too much and you might alienate your audience some?
Certainly, I think there are people who enjoyed Time Traveler who may not like this as well. This book is more astringent and less of a full-blown romantic odyssey. I tried in this book not to be relentless. There is humor in the book, and there are open spaces where I'm not necessarily determining something, where it's possible for the reader to make choices about what's happening and how they're going to think about what the characters are doing.
Well, Audrey Niffenegger, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
Audrey Niffenegger's new novel is titled Her Fearful Symmetry. You can read an excerpt and see a couple of her macabre drawings at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now a recommendation from our series, You Must Read This. Julia Glass won the National Book Award for her debut novel, Three Junes. And today she has this recommendation of a novel she didn't expect to love.
Before I tell you how I fell for this book, let me list a few things about it that would normally have led me to toss it aside. Begin with a title that's just too clever. Love Warps the Mind a Little. The smart-ass narrator is Lafayette Prue, whose cutesy French name shadows the name of the author, John Dufresne. No surprise, Laf is a fiction writer. Call me territorial or narcissistic, but I avoid novels about people who share my vocation. Laf cheats, lies, and freeloads off the women who suffer his philandering ways. He has an absurdly ill-mannered dog and hangs around with a virtual circus of recidivist criminals, New Age psychics, and fast food cooks. I avoid circus novels, too. Why did I read it? Because it was pressed into my hands by Joe DeSalvo of Faulkner House Books in New Orleans. The best booksellers are like trustworthy pushers. Whatever they're dealing, you take it. This book is not luminous or sweeping, poignant or grand. Laf turns out to be a cat-in-the-hat kind of hero, the trickster who lurks on the sidelines while furniture flies, men misbehave, and women weep. He riffs brilliantly on childhood, parenthood, desire, religion, cancer, the very nature of time. Claiming that he'd rather be on fire than be ordinary, he cannot see that if all he does is write about life, then life will pass him by. He knows a lot about love and death, except this, that he is not immune to either. Rarely have I laughed so often while reading a book, or, coming to the end, cried so hard. Love Warps the Mind a Little is a masterpiece of the genre that writers call the funny, sad novel, where humor defies yet gives shape to grief. It is rich entertainment, sheer lunacy, moonshine for the wounded heart. All the best novels are about one thing, how we go on. The characters must survive the fallout of their own cowardice, folly, denial, or misguided passion. They squander what matters most, and still they pick up the pieces. I've been there, and clearly so has John Dufresne.
Julia Glass is the author of the novels I See You Everywhere and Three Junes. Her pick for You Must Read This is Love Warps the Mind a Little by John Dufresne. You can read an excerpt and find more book recommendations at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Every year, U.S. schools hire 250,000 new teachers. Schools are desperate to boost the number of top-quality educators. That means they are casting a wide net, trying to lure people into the classroom from other professions.
NPR is beginning a year-long series on that effort to find, train, and keep the best teachers. And today, NPR's Larry Abramson has this story about a Maryland woman who has switched careers and about the program that's training her for the classroom.
For this group of teachers in training, this is the end of the beginning.
So you're going to have to set up a preschool routine, whatever that may be.
It's August 5th, the last day of a summer training program with the Prince George's County Teaching Fellows, which sends career changers into the classrooms of this Washington, D.C. suburb.
So at 7:45 is when you would start the Do Now, the Math.
Kendra Heffelbauer is only 27 years old, but with 6 years' experience, she is the expert here. She's giving final words of advice to this group. Most are only a few years out of college. One has left behind a quarter century in the banking industry.
I'm going to start with Beverly and go around.
How often do you let them go to the water fountain, and do you have any special procedure?
Beverly Harvey is middle-aged, a former vice president with Citigroup, who decided to switch careers. Beverly asks her water fountain question with a deadly serious expression.
In practice teaching, I would count like 1, 2, 3, so that they wouldn't just stay there too long and just hold up the line.
Classroom management of young students is a key focus here. All of these teachers will be working with the early grades. They want to know, what will my first day be like?
So, like, say they do go in their pants. Like, what do you do?
Questions like that one from a colleague have to remain unanswered. It's time to graduate. Time for Beverly Harvey to fulfill a childhood dream.
This day has finally arrived. This is it.
Beverly Harvey gave up a successful career. She had to take extra classes on her own dime to boost her math qualifications. Now she's signing a piece of paper that turns her magically into a teacher. It's a contract with the Prince George's County School System.
Everything I've done to get to this point, this day, really important to me, very important.
Beverly tears up a bit. Beverly Harvey is the second youngest of seven kids. She grew up in the South, raised by a mother who cleaned houses, a father who could not read or write. Her parents wanted her to do better. Today, she's still inspired by teachers who insisted that she try harder.
My teachers were always kind of on top of me, the good and the bad. And when I see some of these students kind of off track and not kind of believing in themselves that they can't do it, then it's just encouraging them that they can do it and then giving them the opportunity to do it.
Beverly is exactly the kind of person this teaching fellowship is designed for. She's an experienced professional with proven leadership skills who didn't want to go through a traditional teacher's college program. So after a crash course in the summer, including some practice teaching, she's being thrown into the classroom. Experience, it turns out, is a harsh teacher. Oak Crest Elementary School in Landover, Maryland. It's September 9th, 2 weeks into the school year. Beverly Harvey, newly minted teacher, has been handed 33 squirming, fidgeting first graders. Beverly's principal has told her this class will soon be cut in size. Despite all those lessons in managing behavior, Beverly has both hands full. They are a rambunctious bunch. The constant noise interrupts everything she does, every reading lesson.
All right, I'm continuing the story. There's no need to yell, said Frog. I will race you down to the pond, and we will see if you really are the fastest, Frog added. No talking!
She tries a little physical activity to burn off some energy.
Hop on 1 foot.
But that just gets them riled up. In her moment of need, there arrives a rescuer of sorts. Patricia Williams, Beverly's mentor, shows up. Williams has 10 years of experience, and it shows.
Apples high in the tree. Two red apples smiled at me.
Williams moves around the class calmly, rubbing kids' backs to reassure them and to let them know, I'm watching you.
Thank you. Are you ready now? Because I don't think you were ready before. Show Miss Harvey that you're ready.
Patricia Williams has a presence and a confidence that are hard to describe. She also has a superpower at her disposal, a penetrating stare so awe-inspiring, it made me want to fold my hands and hush up.
How do you teach that?
I don't know. I don't know. You just have to, I don't know. You give them the look and they know to stop.
The kids are at lunch. Peace has returned, giving Patricia Williams and Beverly Harvey time for a little debriefing session.
Questions or concerns?
Beverly has made progress since I watched her teach on the first day of school, and she feels she is getting the hang of this.
I like the fact that they pretty much know, like, their morning routine. I have something for them to do. you know, while everybody is coming in.
Like two doctors consulting on a tough case, Williams and Harvey scratch their heads. How can we keep this large class occupied? Williams has a satchel full of activities, chants, and songs to grab kids' attention.
The other one, Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? And there to respond, we got some work to do now.
All right.
So Scooby-Dooby-Doo, where are you? And they should say, we got some work to do now.
The mentor warns Beverly Harvey, kids will get tired of any activity, so she'll have to keep inventing new ones all year long. It's exhausting. Sometimes she renews her dedication by thinking of her illiterate father.
Mm-hmm. Sometime, yeah. Can't let what happened to him happen to them. It's more challenging than I thought, but I'm still having that opportunity to do it. And the need is so great. I see it. All right, let's everyone read it together. Morning class. Alexander likes Australia.
Back in class, Beverly Harvey savors a moment of calm. She has a long way to go, and so far, Beverly still has 33 students in her class. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. If you like sitting in cafes with wireless, enjoying a coffee, and free internet access for as long as you like, that may be getting harder. Small independent cafes are introducing stricter policies to save money while times are tight. They're trying to get more turnover at their tables, as Sarus Farivar reports from Oakland, California.
I'm a freelancer, which means I work at home a lot. When I don't want to work at home, this is where I go, Hudson Bay Cafe. It's a cozy coffee house just a few blocks from home. There's good coffee, a nice atmosphere, and of course, free Wi-Fi. On any given day, there's at least half a dozen people here who are tapping away on their laptops. When I first started coming, they gave me, or anybody, the code for the Wi-Fi network. It was valid for days at a time, but now that's changed.
We've got to turn the tables just like a restaurant does in order to be able to survive.
Owner Sadri Majlessi says too much Wi-Fi is bad for business.
We used to lose customers because they couldn't sit down. Because every single table is taken and every single outlet was taken, I mean, what are they going to do? I mean, they're not going to get a cup of coffee just because I'm here, right?
Now the code changes much more frequently. You can't even get it unless you spend $3. But Majlessi isn't the only cafe owner that's changing the way he runs his Wi-Fi. Last year at Nadri's Cafe and Cocoa Bar in New York, managers started covering up power outlets and limiting the use of Wi-Fi during lunch hours. In Seattle, where they set coffee trends for the whole country, one cafe has had their Wi-Fi on only during weekdays. But other cafe owners aren't sure if Wi-Fi is hurting their business all that much. This summer, Coffee Bar in San Francisco's Potrero Hill neighborhood put up a couple signs asking laptop users to make room for customers who were spending more money. But owner Jason Paul says ultimately it wasn't worth it.
We can sit here and laugh at the guy who comes up and gets 5 refills of hot water, but at the end of the day, he's not going to make or break our business.
Plus, he adds that most of his customers are good Wi-Fi citizens and know when they're abusing the network. For me, though, there's only one place that offers reliable Wi-Fi, my home office. At least I know I won't restrict my own use or kick myself out. For NPR News, I'm Sarus Farivar in my home office in Oakland.
The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation acknowledged today that its insurance fund is close to running out of cash. That's because bank failures continue to mount. The insurance fund pays off depositors when a bank goes under. The FDIC board is proposing a solution. The nation's banks should pay the next 3 years' worth of premiums to the FDIC in advance, a total of $45 billion. And NPR's John Idstey joins us to explain. And John, let's start with this. If the FDIC fund is this close to running out of cash, should Americans who have money in banks be worried that their deposits would be lost if those banks fail?
The answer is no. First, the FDIC has already set aside reserves to handle the most immediate bank failures that it anticipates over the coming months. And second, the FDIC has a $100 billion line of credit at the Treasury Department and could borrow $400 billion more with the approval of the Treasury Secretary and the Fed. So as FDIC Chairwoman Sheila Bair said today, we have tons of money to protect insured depositors.
So if they have these tons of money that she's talking about, why does the FDIC want to force banks to make this huge prepayment, $45 billion?
Well, they don't want to go to the Treasury because of bailout fatigue, according to Sheila Bair. And in fact, the industry itself is concerned about being seen as getting another bailout. So this is actually a plan that the industry is behind, even though the big prepayment would be a bit of a shocker, according to one industry official. But the FDIC is allowing banks to expense the prepayment over time. On the bank's books, it will basically look like they're paying the premiums on the regular schedule over the next 3 years to ease the pain. And I might add that banks that are concerned the big prepayment would seriously weaken them can ask for an exemption.
Now, what about on the lending side, John? Will this $45 billion prepayment make it harder for banks to lend and help the economy recover?
Well, at the margins, that's probably true. It may cut some lending. But although there are a lot of weak banks, there are far more healthy banks. And those banks have lots of money that isn't being lent. Banks keep their excess money on deposit at the Federal Reserve. And right now, there are over $800 billion in excess bank reserves there. So the $45 billion banks will pay to bolster the FDIC insurance fund is only a small portion of the money they have available to make loans.
Why is there so much money on the sidelines then? Why aren't the banks lending more of it out?
Well, it's a combination of lack of demand for loans because in this very difficult economic situation, businesses aren't expanding. On the other side, banks are being extra careful about who they lend to, way too careful, according to some of their customers who want money but can't get it.
John, how big are the fees the banks pay into this insurance fund?
Well, it's currently in the range of 12 to 16 cents on every $100 of deposits that they hold. But today, the FDIC also proposed adding an additional 3 cents to that fee in 2011, something the banks aren't particularly happy about. This proposed rule won't go into effect until after a 30-day comment period, so there still could be some adjustments.
And if those fees are increased, would the insurance fund be out of the woods?
Well, this week, the FDIC revised the total cost of bank failures it expects through 2013 up from $70 billion to $100 billion. So we'll just have to see if this is enough.
Okay. John Idsteadt, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.